The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, from Australia to Britain, from the United States to Canada. More and more people are beginning to worry we may pollute ourselves off the earth before we blast ourselves off the earth. And more I'm beginning to wonder myself. Now, I know it's a possibility because I've seen all the statistics on it. I know that we are living in a world where there is no field we are not polluting. That the problem of our vast growing megalopolis, our huge super cities of today, with the overcrowded conditions, the high-rise apartments, the fantastic gleaming skyscrapers, the millions upon millions of human beings crowded into tiny areas in comparison, a modern curse in a modern world that seems to be bent on destroying itself. And today, the problems of air pollution, of water pollution, of food pollution are growing to serious proportions. Now, some of the really big problems of today, I've been saying on the World Tomorrow program, are so large, so big, they are simply beyond human comprehension. The population explosion by itself is so vast, it virtually defies description. The problems of a world that is in conflict between two huge and differing ideologies, with many, many other ideologies along with them, each with its own private and selfish interests, a world of the stockpiling of atomic bombs and the proliferation of atomic weapons among many other nations, such as now France and China, and with the possibility that in another couple or so decades, we might have as many as 40 different nations possessing atomic weapons, among them India, Pakistan, Malaysia, Indonesia, and countries in Europe. And really, it sort of stands your hair on end when you begin to think about it. Then you look at some of the more local problems, the particularly private problems that we all face. Now, in Australia, people are concerned about growing drought and famine, about upset weather conditions, some of the sheep and cattle stations losing hundreds of thousands of head of cattle and sheep over the course of the last couple of disastrous years, the terrible fires in Tasmania. But not only this, in the big cities we see them becoming more and more crime centers. For instance, in the United States, the one nation that is supposed to lead the world in so many things, and I had a letter the other day where a young teenager was sort of chewing me out for talking about how bad conditions are and said, well, don't you realize the United States is the nation that has come closer to perfection than any other society ever did? I have to answer, my friends, no, I don't realize that, because it isn't true. I don't know what on earth this teenager meant by perfection. But when you look at morality, when you look at the entire panorama of life, we're far from perfection. Now, in some ways, there are improvements, certainly. If you want to look only to produce, only to economy, only to industry, only to science, and to miniaturization, electronics, to the automation and industry and all of these various mechanical and technological advancements, people can become confused by these things. They don't seem to realize that as we build the machine, we tend to tear down the man. And the more we build the machine, the more we seem to pollute our environment with those machines. But here in the United States, where we are supposed to lead the world in so many things, we lead the world instead in crime. And the capital of the United States of America is one of the worst examples of any city on the face of this earth with regard to crime. People literally, absolutely afraid to go out of their homes at night. People afraid to walk down the streets in Washington, D.C. Whole sections of Washington, D.C. virtually taken over by roving gangs. Crime out of all proportion to either total population and out of all proportion to race. When you consider the percentages of race involved, and it doesn't make a bit of sense. There is no excuse and no reason for it. Now, it's about time you were willing to take a good long look at this world and to ask yourself a few stark and serious questions. People ask this kind of a question. I know it's one of the questions that is most often asked of any theologian, for example. Living in a world as cruel as this is, living in a world, this kind of a world, this world of the atomic bomb, this terrible world, how can I have faith in a God? As a matter of fact, written by a leading theologian in the United States recently, who is Samuel H. Miller, Dean of Harvard Divinity School, in a magazine article entitled, In a World Threatened by Nuclear Destruction, What Can I Believe? That very title was used for the article. In a world threatened by nuclear destruction, what can I believe? Some of the things he said were interesting. He said, this is a terrible world. Make the rounds of people on every level. Something's wrong, they all say, and it ought to be righted. Even in peace, we're not at peace, either with others or with ourselves. In our work, we find no purpose. In our frenzy, there is no direction. Many of us, he said, both in the church and out of it, ask, well, what can religion offer men in times like these? And he went on to say, to many, faith still smells of superstition, of the dark ages, of a surrender not commendable in a mature mind. Multitudes have found it easy to substitute many things for religious faith, all the way from the distractions of TV to the principles of science. As this teenager was doing in saying, don't you know we've reached nearly perfection? Closer to it than any other society? No, I don't know that. Now, as this theologian said, faith confronts large and tragic confusions of meaning. We ask, what can I believe? Given our world and our experience, is it sensible to believe in God? That's a good question. One of the hardest questions that a theologian claims he has ever faced with is a question such as that. How can you believe in God in today's world? How can you believe in a God when you see around you sorrow, suffering, sickness, disease, famine, upset weather, growing problems between and among nations, proliferation of nuclear weapons, mounting starvation, threat of famine, food wars in the future looming on the horizon in the next decade or two? People telling us they're not even certain mankind is going to survive. So people say, well, you can't tell me in a world as bad as this is that I can believe in a God. Well, now let's put that on the shelf just for a few moments. Let me just tell you a few more things about our modern society. First of all, we don't like to admit it is the way it is. We like to kid ourselves because it is too big for us to grasp. It's a little more frightening than we can stand. It's a little beyond our ken, as we use that form of speech. But when you look at our polluted cities, at our vast and growing crime centers, at the fact of mounting divorce and the destruction of the sanctity of the home, when you look at the dissolution of religion and therefore the growing movement toward religious unity, when you look at the problems among and between nations and begin to realize that today there is absolutely more concourse between and more unity among many European countries than at any time since the ancient Holy Roman Empire, it's about time we began to realize we are on the brink of something big. That everything altogether, the whole scope of it must be looked at, that you cannot afford to look at one little tiny aspect of society and judge the rest of it by that one narrow view. Why is it in most of the attempts to predict the future, you see only a wildly glowing prediction about a helicopter on every front yard, about three cars and two boats, about mechanical gadgets and a vacuum cleaner with an electronic eye that wanders around the room and does your work for you, about more leisure, and if you can imagine this grisly, ghastly statement, a one-shot hypo injected into the body of a fetus before its birth, which would immunize it from every disease that is even remotely known or imagined by mankind. A one-shot vaccination that is supposed to completely cushion a human being from every disease he can begin to get. Men think they can play God. They want to become God. They want other human beings to look up to them in awe and say, save me from my problems. Give me a shot. Cut something out. Give me some kind of a chemical. Make me well. It's absolutely amazing. Now, the average person isn't willing to look at it, and the reason we're not willing to look at it, my friends, is because we're afraid of it. Because we are afraid of the way it's going to come out. Because we are fearing the future, and we don't need to. The future is a lot better and brighter than a lot of you begin to assume. But it is not better and brighter because of a dependence upon the mechanical gleaming artifacts of human beings. It is not brighter and better because we depend upon one or another or several human governments, or upon human economy, or man's industry, or technology, or science, or man's medicines. Now, when you look at the world in general, and I could talk, of course, and so could anybody else, for the next 200 programs and do nothing but talk about the problems. I don't intend to do that. That isn't my purpose in being on the air. But if you don't understand some of the problems, how can you begin to even realize we need solutions? And how can you begin to find what the solutions are? Can you tell me what field there is that you can point to wherever you live? What field, what aspect of human endeavor, what facet of life is it we are not polluting today? Can you think of a one where we're literally improving? What about education? Are we polluting education? Historians say they must be good party men. College students cheat. Professors say they know it. Standards are watered down. They say there are no values, no absolutes, no positive principles. They have today a sort of a modern skepticism, a crass, griping, ignominious new approach to education, which says, oh yeah, to everything. A so-called new morality, which is merely ancient, sloppy, sort of trashy, Babylonish, and Egyptian immorality, dress up filth in a tuxedo, knot a tie around his rotten neck, and call it moral. Can you tell me education is not being polluted today? Let me tell you this, and I can prove it. The biggest pollution in education is the fact that education is shot through with evolution, with an anti-God philosophy. The fact that from chemistry to mathematics, people deny God. They will not look at it. It isn't that people will ask themselves and will prove over and over again whether or not a God exists. It isn't that people will take the assumptions of paleontology, of zoology, of chemistry, of biology, microbiology, of astronomy, the many sciences, physical sciences, as well as the so-called humanities and all the rest of it, and actually put it up for grabs. I mean, throw the whole thing up in the air, in the words of architects, and let it come down and sort of take another look at it. Kick it around, as they say. Look at it plainly and ask themselves and question some of the basic precepts of education today. You don't do this or you're going to get laughed out of a classroom. You're going to get flunked out of a classroom. You're going to get so ridiculed, the average person is simply going to shut up and say no more or get out of that class. And you students in the higher educational institutions know that is true. And I get plenty of letters that tell me that. And I've seen it and rubbed shoulders with it, and I know it. And our historians at the ambassador colleges and our professors also take courses in many of these institutions, and we have students that come from every major and well-known institution of any real note. And that means not in just one country, but in many nations. And I happen to know what I speak about when I talk about education. And today, we like to call it education, all this misknowledge that we're trying to funnel into young, unsuspecting minds, and don't realize that we haven't really given it a fair shake. That we have not given it a real chance. That too many people have just assumed, because it's natural, casual, and almost comfortable for a human being with his own carnal mind to believe there isn't any God, that he's self-sufficient, he doesn't need God, he wants God to keep his nose out of his business, he wants to be left alone, he would like to have some other excuse. So we try to explain vast, limitless space, the fabulous, almost incredible universe, the creation, in other words, all the elements, matter, and how it works, which is a fabulous study. When you begin to study chemistry, it is regarded as one of the very high sciences, one of the very difficult sciences. Why, top-notch chemists are regarded as very erudite and studious and very intelligent and scientific individuals. They are in a field which the world tends to respect, yet all they are doing is learning about how one part of matter works upon and affects another, and how several combinations do this and that and abide by certain laws. All they are learning is what has been compacted and put into this great universe and this earth that we call the creation. And yet human beings want to say there is a creation, but there is no creator. You look at life, we take life for granted, and yet life is a miracle. A baby is a miracle. A plant is a miracle. A tree, a blade of grass is a miracle. What is that pattern that is in a little infinitesimal seed that you can take apart with your fingernails and you can't see a thing in there? And yet indelibly stamped in it is the size, the shape, the texture, the bark, the color, and the exact shape of the leaf in this tiny, little, microscopically perfect cellular and molecular construction of a leaf. And yet it's all in that seed, in that pattern, indelibly stamped. We look at it, we take it for granted. We plant a beanstalk comes up and more beans, until we see not only life, but life after its own kind. And we say life is possible without a life giver. You came by yourself without parents, did you? Who were the first parents? How did it ever get started? Why did male and female evolve? Did you ever really put evolution to the test? I have. We teach evolution. We don't teach that it's true because it isn't. We teach all of the vast, unbelievable, broad, yawning Grand Canyons of bottomless abysses that are filled with the doubt that is left in the shot through, fabricated, old, torn rag, the straw man of evolution. Because evolution does not have the answers, and just because somebody wears a board on his head and gets a very, very pompous expression and has a lot of dignity and begins to speak in a certain affected way and try to tell you that evolution is true, well, maybe you better look into it for yourself and quit letting other people do your thinking for you. Time that you began to prove a few things to yourself. We look at the intricacy of design. The natural design in nature, anything from the universe and astronomy down to the earth, the complexity and interdependency of it, then the vastness of the oceans and the life cycle that is there. Well, I'll tell you, the study of plankton, the study of the life cycle of the food for fish and the cycle of life in the ocean is such an astounding, such a breathtaking study that by itself, one little aspect of this earth of ours, of this creation, ought to stand your hair on end and make you get on your knees and acknowledge there is a God and you can prove it. But education ignores this today. It doesn't teach it at all. It shies away from it. Education is polluted. What field can you look at? Can you say government has escaped pollution? Well, we know better, don't we? Can you say art, literature, music has escaped pollution? You know, when you look at literature, we're living in the age of trash, the age of total trash, the age of irrelevancy, of weird, demoniacal novels, of one-eyed and three-eyed, many-toed monsters with six hands and green skin and scales. You see it on the cover of some of the science fiction novels. A time of murder, of the bludgeoning, twisting, hooking, knifing, slashing, stabbing, choking, and beating of human flesh. Books about intrigue, about perverted sex, twisted sex, filthy sex, immoral sex, illegal sex, homosexual sex. The age of wild, weird opinion sharing. You've got an idea, and I think you're nutty, but I'm willing to listen to it, and then I tell you mine, and you think mine is nutty, and you're willing to listen to that. And what a lot of crass ignorance and superstition that is. You know, people water down their ideals so much today, they're willing to sit around and share a lot of nutty, oddball ideas and say, well, of course, that's my opinion. Then to smile and say, well, of course, I know, and I disagree with you, but then this is my opinion. And so we're in the age of total blather. Blither, drivel, and blather. And you hear people yakking it up and talking back and forth, but they will never get to the trunk of the tree. They will never get down to the absolutes. They will never walk right into that unescapable blind alley from which there is no escape, except to admit to ourselves, if you say there is no God, then you must say, I'm sorry, I am ignorant. I don't know. And I guess there are people that say, hooray, we're ignorant. In other words, I'm agnostic. Now, you know, Gnosticism meant we know. It meant knowledge. So agnosticism means we don't know. What a very accurate label. And so many people wear it today. They say, I don't know. Well, I suppose that's honest. But the thing of it is, my friends, when a person doesn't know, don't you think he ought to find out? You know, not knowing maybe is not a sin by itself, but it can be if a person sinks down and gets comfortable with it. If he keeps it, what he ought to do is get rid of it and come to know. So, you know, in literature, now you know this. I'm not trying to get you to believe it. If you're willing to admit it to yourself, and if you are honest with yourself, you know that we live in a time of total trash in literature. The age of nutty, weird, depraved superstition, science fiction, murder, divorce, sex. The more out of balance it seems, the more offset it seems, the more perverted, weird, distorted, and twisted a thing is, the better some people like it. What is there that is not twisted in these fields that reach our minds today? The entertainment the educational, the fields of knowledge, the fields of experience, the fields of recreation. And so much of the literature is, of course, designed around recreational and relaxational purposes. What about art? What isn't polluted, twisted, and perverted about it today? Now, it's possible to still have good art. I know many people that are still producing good art. I know it's possible. I've tried to have a little hand at it myself. I enjoy trying to paint a landscape. I don't claim to do very well at it, but at least it makes a little bit of sense that people look at it and say, oh, I see you're trying to paint mountains in a tree, and that's gratifying. But it seems today that the more twisted and perverted, the more grotesque, the more offset, the more oddball, the more out of harmony and confusing it is, the more people seem to crave it. Now, nobody knows what he's seeing in it, but it's a sort of an intellectual vanity. People stand around and they know that nobody else sees anything in it, but each person seems to think the other person sees something in it, and really, they value each other's opinion, and so they say, Now, I don't like to just observe art, one will say. I like to experience it. Oh, that's nice. That's a bunch of words, but what does it mean? Nobody knows. It's worth about as much as a flake of dandruff. Nobody knows exactly what that means to himself or anybody else. It means the same thing to a sixth grader looking out the window at a butterfly. It means looking at something and letting your mind wander, that's all, and then trying to call it intellectualism and criticism. You know, like pop art, like nailing shingles, bottle caps, old inner tubes, bed springs, rusty nails, an oily rag, and maybe the bumper from a 1937 Dodge truck on a wall, and call it art. Well, you might as well. They're mislabeling everything else today. Truth is mislabeled. History is mislabeled. Education is mislabeled. You might as well mislabel art, I guess. You know, one group of characters are making records of the noise they make as they smash a piano. I saw a picture in a leading magazine. And they're going to sell this record they make as they bash, smash, hack, and bludgeon a piano into splinters. And they're going to sell this record. And I guess people will buy it like wildfire, like it's going out of style. I suppose they will. I haven't the faintest idea. But then, I guess you might as well smash it. At least you might as well smash it and sell a record of the smashing of piano, I suppose, is to use the piano to elicit base emotions, use it to inspire depraved thought, to appeal to sensual, degrading impulses. You might as well smash it. But a piano is an instrument that can produce some very beautiful, some uplifting, and some very lovely sounds that make you want to whistle a tune, make your work happier, make your day a little brighter. But you know, all this perverted, twisted, oddball stuff shows the confusion, the defeatism, the age of irrelevancy in which we live, and the fear that is driving many people out of their minds. It really does. We might as well admit it. People aren't sure of the future. They are insecure. And everything, our art, our literature, our music, our language, and so on, is beginning to show it. You look at the sculpture work that you're beginning to see more and more on public buildings, and what various sculptors are doing. And you know, it seems the more difficult it is to figure out, the more people like it. Weird, distorted, out-of-shape things. Some of it moving and so on. Some of it just a jangled collection of old bent tubes and glass and pieces of bottles and sticks and old rusty springs and the like, and they call it sculpture. It makes you wonder why the junk man just doesn't put a torch to the whole business and kind of melt it all down together and hang it on some giant wall someplace and win a prize. And really, people are literally doing that, I guess. Just calling it art, but really it's just junk and garbage, slop. One of these days, I suppose somebody's going to get around to painting something out of a garbage can. I mean, just taking the sloppy garbage and everything is rotting and decaying and flinging it on a wall and saying, now look, that's art. And I've never heard of that being done before, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised what somebody's already beat me to it or else thought of it ahead of time. So I know that probably is not original at all. You're living in the age of pollution, the age of depravity, the age of irrelevancy, the age of rejection, of hopelessness, of defeat and disillusionment. But why? These aren't normal times. It wasn't meant to be this way. Human beings are on this earth for a purpose. They are meant to be happy. They are meant to find right standards and true values and their real purpose in life and to get busy and fulfill that purpose. They're meant to qualify for a greater life. A fuller life, a more vital and creative life. And I mean that far beyond what you might think I mean it. I mean a literal creative life. Now, there's only one source to which you can go for solutions to the meaning of life itself. And you're told by philosophers and educators that the really big questions of all are, who am I? Why am I? What am I? Isn't it amazing that with all the knowledge that man has collected and amassed today, he fails to know what he is? Man does not know what he is and why he is here. But if you are willing to look to that one source for solutions, you have to ask yourself a few step-by-step questions. Is there a God after all? Is there a divine architect, a creator, a life giver, a designer, a law giver who gave laws, who designed, who gave life, who created, who produced and brought into being all things? Can you prove it? I've got a booklet for you that will do just that, a series of articles coming along just about every month in the Plain Truth magazine that show you exactly in detail and yet in very readable form and laughable form sometimes, with once in a while even a humorous cartoon to go along about the questions involved in evolution. Coming up now, one of the most fantastic stories of all about these migratory creatures, and there are many migratory creatures beside birds. When you read about some of these fantastic escapades, these migrations of little creatures, and they're almost incredible, unbelievable, powers to arrive at the same nest, the same twig, on a tree after flights of thousands of miles, it will take your breath. Continually, the books on science call it a mystery. They continually admit they don't know, and they don't. That's true. At least that's honest. It is a mystery to them. It's not a mystery to me, because I know who created it. I know who put that sense that human beings don't even have instruments or knowledge to find out. I know that there is an instinct that causes them to migrate, a sort of a driving instinct that puts it into that little tiny bird brain or that little insect brain. If you could even say they have a brain that science is not even able to uncover and to understand. Now, you'll be amazed. It will surprise you. I think it'll make your heart beat a little faster. It will also very greatly gratify you and give you some real peace to read those articles. And every month, an article along that line will come. Now, also, the booklets on Does God Exist will prove to you whether or not there is a God. And the next question, of course, is does that God, if he does exist and you can prove it, does that God talk to us through his word? Is it relevant? Can you depend on it? Can you trust it? Does it make any sense? You may not realize the Bible gives the answers to all these problems of today. And the answer to that question is found in the booklet on the proof of the Bible. Now next, marching right on out into the future to a world that is not polluted and not grotesque, is this booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It's free of charge. It tells you more than anything else exactly what this program is all about. What I believe, what I stand for, what I'm trying to do, what I'm telling you is coming. Why, you're getting the advance news of it. This booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, is, of course, free. It all is. There's not even so much as a coupon on the overleaf. There is not one coupon to send in. There is no bill to follow. No one's going to request money from you. Nobody's going to knock on your door. No one's going to get your telephone number. If you want it, you can have it, but all it takes is the courage to write for it by sending your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, 31, just 111, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.